Afterward. I've presented only the novelette because, as before, it is impractical to try to present the novel itself as well. If you are interested in a direct comparison and do not have a copy of the novel, Ballantyne has recently put out a new paperback edition of The End of Eternity. Meanwhile, I will say a few words of my own. In the case of Grow Old Along With Me, I had to add comparatively little to turn it into Pebble in the Sky. This meant I could use the plot as was, and simply rearrange it and go into a few things in greater detail. Not so in the case of The End of Eternity, novelette, where I had to triple the length. There I had a much freer hand in actually revising the plot. I made some small changes, of course. First, I changed the name of my character, Anders Horum, to Andrew Harlan. Why? I'm not certain. Some people, after reading the novel, have suggested that I made use of the name Harlan as a reference to Harlan Ellison. That's not impossible. I had met Harlan Ellison in September 1953, and of course he made a deep impression on me, as he does on everyone. I would not have been surprised, then, if I had named the character Andrew Harlan in the original novelette, which I began within 2 months of the meeting. I did not, however. I called him Anders Horum. Why, then, should I have made the change in the novel? Here's what seems reasonable to me. Horum had been a rather minor character in the novelette, but I made him into the actual hero in the novel, and Horum strikes me as a particularly ugly name. It was suitable for an unpleasant minor character, but not for the hero. When I do make name changes, I tend to make them as small as I can. I don't know why. So I changed Anders to Andrew and Horum to Harlan. Then, too, Manfield, an important character in the novelette, disappeared in the novel, or rather his role was combined with that of Twistle. As for Noyce, her role was greatly expanded, and the love story was made even more central to the development of the story than had been true in the novelette. But what really astonished me, as I read both versions in preparing for this book, was that I didn't simply dilute the novelette. After all, if the novelette was really a dehydrated novel, I might have merely added water, so to speak, lengthened the descriptions, carried on the dialogue at greater length, and stuck to the plot. I didn't. Having Bradbury's praise in my ears and suddenly finding myself with 50,000 more words to play with, I added incidents and complications, and made the novel every bit as dense as the novelette had been. In particular, there was the matter of the ending. In rereading the novelette for this book, I was amazed that I had made the ending as weak as I had. At least, it seemed weak to me now in comparison with what I had done for the ending of the novel. After all, I called the story The End of Eternity, and yet I had not had the courage, or the heart perhaps, actually to end eternity in the novelette. In the novel, I determined to make a better job of it, perhaps because, it being a novel now, I wanted to tie it in somehow with earlier books of mine dealing with the rise and fall of the Galactic Empire. It's a weakness of mine to try to make my science fiction novels consistent with each other, and it influences my writing to this very day. In any case, the end of the novel is far more complex and dramatic than is the end of the novelette. In the novel, I tried, as I often do in my novels, to uncover several surprises, one after the other, until it seems to me that the reader feels he has come to the end. And then I produce one last surprise that I have held in reserve. It's fun to do, but not easy. In the case of The End of Eternity as a novel, the density did not work entirely in its favor. I showed the novel to Horace Gold, in case he felt I had improved the story and was therefore willing to serialize it prior to publication. Such serialization in those days meant an additional $1,500 or so for the ever-impoverished author. Gold, however, rejected it as swiftly and as uncompromisingly as he had rejected the novelette. Nor would Campbell accept it for Astounding. Doubleday tried to peddle it for serialization to some of the general magazines and got nowhere at all. Not surprising in 1955, when science fiction was virtually an aberration outside the few specialty magazines devoted to it. The result was that The End of Eternity never saw magazine publication of any kind. Pebble in the Sky also appeared in book form without any magazine publication, but after its book appearance, it appeared twice in slightly condensed form. It appeared in the first issue of Two Complete Science Adventure Books and in Galaxy Science Fiction Novels. The End of Eternity never experienced such second serialization. Nor were some of the critics particularly kind to it. Their objections usually rested on its density. Damon Knight referred to the confusing nature of the opening chapters in a rather caustic fashion, for instance. Even Anthony Boucher, then editor of Fantasy and Science Fiction, who was an unusually gentle fellow and a good friend of mine, thought it was too complicated. I remember that we were both at the World Science Fiction Convention in Cleveland in 1955, at which I was the guest of honor and he the toastmaster. We were both being interviewed by someone who asked me what my most recent book was. I said, a science fiction novel named The End of Eternity. He shoved the microphone under my nose and said, can you give us an idea of the plot in a few sentences? I stammered and made a false start, and Tony Boucher chuckled and said, even you can't do it for that book, Isaac. I said, yes, I can, Tony. I was just caught by surprise. Ask me the question again, sir. The interviewer obliged, and I rattled off several clear sentences outlining the plot. Its sales were comparable to those of my other novels of the 1950s. It has appeared in paperback form a number of different times and has been translated into 14 foreign languages that I know of, including Russian and Hebrew, so I don't consider it a failure. I do consider it underappreciated, however, and feel it is unfairly drowned out by my Foundation novels and my robot novels. Someday, after I'm dead perhaps, it may come into its own. Before I leave the world of my novels, I want to mention briefly the case of another novelette, even shorter than the novelette version of The End of Eternity, which I expanded to a novel somewhat longer than the novel version of The End of Eternity. At a local science fiction convention on January 15, 1971, someone on the stage, seeking under pressure for an example of an obscure isotope, referred to plutonium-186. I was amused because there is no such thing as plutonium-186, and there can't be. I decided, therefore, to write a short story on the subject of plutonium-186 and to submit it for inclusion in an anthology of originals that was going to be edited by the person who made the remark and published by Doubleday. Unfortunately, the story ran away with me and, at 20,000 words, proved to be a novelette. I was afraid it was now too long for the anthology, and so I consulted Lawrence P. Ashmead on that point. He was my editor at Doubleday at that time, and he it was who would also be handling the anthology. Larry read my story and said he didn't want it in the anthology. He wanted me to make a novel out of it. So I did, but I didn't touch the novelette at all, not one word. I kept it as a beginning and added two more long novelettes that continued the story. Altogether, the three made up a 90,000-word novel, The Gods Themselves, Doubleday, 1972. In that case, there is no alternative Asimov, however, for the novelette out of which it grew is right there in the book as the first of three parts.